Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Dave Hendon.
And I'm Michael McMullen.
And welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. We're back. Thank you to Peter Devlin for last week. I get the feeling if I hadn't had to wrap it up, I'd still be talking to Peter. Nice lad, very nice lad, and nice to see someone with a bit of personality. I hope he does well. We'll see him very shortly in the shootout. This episode is called Puffery and Liars. That's Puffery and Liars. It's not an old sitcom from the 1980s starring Richard Briers. It is. I got the phrase from. I was watching the inauguration coverage on CNN. Joe Biden. And they showed Donald Trump's last speech as president. It was a bizarre, hard to believe, I know, but a bizarre occasion. He was at the airbase and there was sort of 30 lunatics sort of cheering every word. And he did this speech where he just basically said how great he'd been and how well he'd done and so on and so on. And then left to YMCA. still don't quite understand. Anyway, they went back to the CNN's, I can't remember who it was, but it was one of their anchors. And he said, there we are, that's the last time we'll hear from Donald Trump as president. No more of his puffery and lies. And I thought, oh, that's a good phrase. I'll be having that. So the reason it's called this episode is called that is because later on we're going to be just looking at a few sort of myths that have grown up over the years. Quite a few of them we've started ourselves, I'm sure. But some others as well that actually when they're looked at maybe are not true. So we're going to some of the sort of great myths of snooker folklore. I was speaking to you, or we're recording this anyway, on Walter Donaldson's birthday, and that's something to say.
Well, I mean, that's all anyone's talking about on the Twitter sphere today, I believe.
Yeah.
1907. When did he die? He died about early 80s, was it?
In the 70s. I mean, Walter Donaldson, for those who don't know, he was the first person to win the world title other than Joe Davis. He won it twice, beat Fred Davis. In those days, you know, it was sort of best of 140-odd. They played all the dead frames. In fact, Clive unearthed an extraordinary stat about some of those world finals. Not only did they play the dead frames, that they actually potted every ball of every frame.
Wow.
So a bit like Ronnie was doing recently, you know, just
playing,
I mean, literally, you know, just really wringing it dry of anything.
Wasn't Walter Donaldson, because some player of that era, who, when he finally decided to stop playing and just didn't even want to practice anymore, was it Walter Donaldson? Someone did. They smashed up the table and used the slates, their practice table, they smashed it up and they took the slates and used them to pave their driveway.
That's exactly what he did. What he did, because, of course, the problem was, and we'll get on to the sort of the current topic shortly, but the problem was in those days, obviously, Joe Davis retired from the World Championship, but he still played other events and he played exhibitions and he was by far the biggest name in the sport. And so you had the World Championship completely devalued. The best player wasn't in it. And there was no TV coverage really or anything like that. So the game just went into complete, you know, dissolute. I mean, it completely dissolved into nothing. And he became frustrated. There were no opportunities. And you're quite right. In the end, he smashed up his table, used it to pave a path in his garden. But he was the first Scottish world champion before Stephen Hendry. And we dedicate this podcast this week to Walter Donaldson.
Wow.
I'm sure he'd be delighted. If he was alive, he'd smash his table up again, I think. Anyway.
He'd probably smash his computer up once he'd heard what we'd said about him. Do you reckon there's ever been another podcast ever dedicated to Walter Donaldson in the entire history of the internet?
Well, I don't know, but I'll tell you who's got, again, we will get to the big issue shortly. David Dimbleby's got a podcast, which I was amazed by. I thought he would thumb his nose at all that stuff.
Oh.
But that shows you that podcasting is, he's doing a podcast about the Iraq War, which is very, very, very interesting. Anyway, we're not here to talk about David Dimbleby. What we are here to talk about, as I say, we'll get to the main topic later on, the myths that have grown up in the snooker world. We're going to talk about the German Masters shortly. Firstly, though, big news today, a new sponsor, Cazoo, car salespeople, online salespeople. They're a big deal, actually, a big company. They're going to be sponsoring the ITV series of events. So World Grand Prix from next season, the Players' Championship and the Tour Championship. Great little series, that. And great to have not only a new sponsor in the time of a pandemic, but, of course, they're not a gambling firm. That's, you know, I think snooker kind of, a lot of people felt were going down the tobacco route, and a lot of people feel that that will come to an end through legislation. But that's good, and maybe that will be the start of, you know, if they're coming in, other companies potentially will follow. But all credit to Barry and the team for getting them.
Yeah, absolutely. A huge company. I mean, they sponsor two different Premier League teams. I mean, you know, that shows you what a big organisation we're talking about here. It'll lend itself to all sorts of Tom Ford jokes when the tournaments themselves come around, if he's in them. And here's a trivia question for you that I'm not sure I know the answer to, but I think I do.
You see, you don't get this with David Dimbleby's podcast.
No, indeed. we could call this our sort of question time. It's our tribute to David Dimbleby's efforts. So, what was the last tournament to be sponsored by a car company?
Well, I remember the Skoda Grand Prix, of course.
Actually, that's right. So my answer was wrong.
What was your answer?
Skoda. No, God, I'd forgotten about that one. In between the two, the British Car Rental World Cup in 1990. That was the tournament where Alex threatened to have Dennis shot. And, So other ones as well. There must have been someone else along the way. Like, Skoda definitely would be the last one, because they were still sponsoring the Grand Prix in 95. Laddie have mentioned as well, British Car Rental. There must have been another one along the way.
Well, they didn't sponsor the event, but of course the Kilkenny Masters only held one.
They put up a
car as the prize for a maximum, and then they decided that for some reason that wasn't going to be the prize, but they left it parked outside the venue. And of course Ronnie O'Sullivan made a maximum, and quite understandably. Went in the tournament office and said, you know, kind of rubbing his hands together, where are the keys? Oh, sorry, yeah, we withdrew that.
Slight correction to that story. I mean, that's broadly true. we're on to the myths already, because that isn't exactly what happened. You were there, Dave. I mean, you should remember this. He went to the tournament office, or at least I think he walked past it, but I do know for a fact nobody was in the tournament office, because they'd all scarpered, because they knew what was coming. And the thing was, he had made the 147 in the final frame. I think he was playing Joe Swale, and there was an unbelievable reaction. The clip is on YouTube. It's fantastic stuff. Go and look. You've never seen a snooker crowd like it. He comes in, all delighted with himself. He's won a car. So, of course, I was the press officer, so I had the pleasure, as the only remotely official person on the premises by that stage, of informing him, well, actually, Ronnie, afraid to say there isn't a car, despite the one outside. It was a whole new twist on the whole bullseye. Here's what you could have won. You know, and then they show you the prize. In this case, it was, well, here's what you did win, and we're going to show you the prize, but you're still not getting it. So, yeah. I know there's definitely been another car sponsor. It'll probably hit me in about 10 minutes, and I'll shout it out. So we'll come back to that.
Fair enough. Great news
to have Cazoo on board for all those tournaments, and, you know, a huge company, as you say. Hopefully it is the start of things to come on that front.
You're mentioning Alex Higgins there. I was just watching this morning. On YouTube, someone's got the original BBC coverage of his 1982 victory, and I'm always interested to see how they, you know, how it. We all remember, we've seen the footage of him beckoning his baby and all the rest of it, his wife. But how did the BBC? Was there an interview and whatever? How did it work? So basically, what happens is the final finishes, Ted Lowe wraps it up, and then David Vian from the studio sort of just narrates the presentation. And obviously reacts to what he's watching. But then very quickly, they're off the air. I mean, the credits are rolling. There's no interview. I think the first interview, and we will get to the big issues of the day shortly. But I think the first interview in the arena after World Final wasn't until the Black Ball Final in 85, because I've seen the 84 post-final, and that was in the studio. I remember that because they had sandwiches.
We don't need to even get to the ones we'd written down. 81, definitely when Steve won it, if you remember, David Vine does come out into the arena holding a microphone, so definitely that one. I don't know about any other years, but certainly
why
that
they stopped,
one.
Yeah, I wonder why they stopped that. Anyway, let's move on. The shootout, of course, is back this week, and Scott Fife has emailed. This is a lot of people have been asking this question, actually. Scott says, how do you see the lack of any crowd this time impacting the shootout? Will it lead to the potential for different players contending? Does it diminish the event given the role the crowd played? Well, I think anyone can win it anyway. I think just because of the nature of the rules. Here's the thing, okay? There's going to be crowd noise. I can reveal this. There's going to be crowd noise. It's recorded from previous shootouts. It's going to be mainly for the TV audience. The players will hear it only faintly. It won't be as loud in the arena as it is listening to it on TV. It's quite hard, actually, because, I mean, there are very generic sort of chants in that shootout. Like the yellow has its own chant. We're going back to what we talked about a couple of weeks ago here, like the pink has the Pink Panther theme tune, all that stuff. And of course, different players have their own, like Robbie Williams gets all the Robbie Williams stuff and so on and so on. But it's going to be generic. It's just to try and create a bit of buzz, because I must admit, I did think this might be one event that wouldn't happen purely because it is so associated with the crowd. But I don't think it diminishes the event. We've seen, so many tournaments, like the Masters, I was convinced, was going to be not that great this year because it's always been associated with a big crowd. Once the snooker starts, as we've seen, we saw it again last week, you just get into the snooker. I know not everyone likes the shootout. One thing I will say is I've been to the last couple for Eurosport, and every night where I've left the venue, it's been in Watford, every night I've left the venue, people have had smiles on their faces, which is a good thing. It might not be for everyone, but the people who go to it love it. It's a good day out. You don't have to sit quietly. You can just enjoy yourself. So I think it will miss the crowd, but I think the actual, when those shootout frames are close and exciting, they're great to watch. They're not all like that. Some of them peter out quite quickly. In fact, the final did really last year. Holtze won it really easily. But I still think it has the potential to be exciting. You can't paper over the fact there's not a crowd, but they're going to do their best.
I'm just disappointed Stephen Hendry didn't enter it, because as you say, anyone can win, really. So he could have turned up, won it, and reclaimed a share of the record number of ranking titles won. Fantastic stuff it would have been. But yeah, look, it's a chance for someone. I mean, it had a huge impact last year, because as a result of the shootout, going into that, Ronnie O'Sullivan was in the 16 for the Players' Championship, which of course he would have been defending champion in, but because of the results of the shootout, he ended up missing out on it. And Michael Holt obviously got into play in the Players' Championship, and I think he played Judd, didn't he, in his first match, and gave him a decent enough contest. So, look, reality is, whether you think it should be a ranking event or not, it can have a very big impact now, particularly now that the first prize has gone up to £50,000. You know, it can really have a huge impact on your season. So, we will see how it unfolds.
I saw Holtze, because it was in Southport, the Players' Championship, and essentially, I'm pretty sure it was, maybe not the next day, probably was the Tuesday, he was sat at breakfast, and of course that was the first people had seen him since he won, and all the other players, like John Higgins, these people were coming over to him, congratulating him, and he was like sort of some sort of monarch sat there, like receiving guests, as Stephen Fry would say, like a pig in Chardonnay. But anyway, that's the shootout. Now, the German Masters, of course, was just staged. We could maybe just play a recording of podcasts from the last couple of years. Congratulating Judd Trump again. It was a strange old week for him. He started it not in great fashion, I thought. He made some pretty foolish comments about his COVID test, essentially saying, he told the press that he reckoned he hadn't had the virus. It was a false positive. He should have been allowed to play in the Masters. Here's the thing about that. He's not qualified to say that. Firstly, we were told initially he didn't have any symptoms. He actually said he did have some. He felt he had a cold. All World Snooker can do is use this private health company and rely on their results. It's not to say there's no false positives in any of the tests, but they can't know that. They can't make a special case for him. He might have felt fine. The point is, and this is why, and I had it as well, this is why you have to isolate. You can pass it on to someone who wouldn't be fine, particularly someone in a vulnerable age category or someone who's got underlying health issues. So Of course he didn't want to miss the Masters. Of course he was disappointed by that. But I thought his comments were rather strange and showed a bit of an ignorance about how it all works.
Well, astonishing to hear someone called Trump making ill-informed comments about COVID, But anyway, there we go. Yeah, I mean, I hadn't actually heard that there wasn't, I knew he'd said something. That was the first time what you've just said there that I've heard it in detail. But look, if you didn't have these, if you weren't doing these tests and, abiding by the outcome, these tournaments wouldn't be happening. So,
yeah,
end of story, really.
Well, he made up for it. I mean, of course, the two players that had to pull out the Masters got to the final.
Yeah.
Judd Trump and Jack Lazowski. I think, objectively, over the week, again, Trump wasn't at his dazzling best all the time, but when it looked like, and it did look like he was going to lose in the semi-finals to Barry Hawkins, I mean, it really did, he turned it on in spectacular fashion. And when we got to the final, I think with these two, they both Judd and Jack have got, great A games. Trump's got a much better B game, and that came to the fore. He won the close frames in the final, and he kind of, I actually thought Lazowski had a great chance. I thought in some ways it was his best chance to win the tournament just because he was so confident. But he's come up against a winning machine, and Trump knows how to win now. And, again, very, very impressive to keep on this kind of week in, week out dedication he's got and determination of the sort that Davis and Hendry had to just turn up whatever the tournament is and win it.
And it must be getting in Lazowski's head now. I meant to ask you this the other day, actually, and I'm pretty sure the answer is no. Has any other player ever lost his first five ranking finals?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's been a few who've lost four. Ryan
Day. Yeah.
Ryan Day, obviously Gilbert at the moment. Graham Dott, actually, was another one. But I don't think so, no.
You look at Dott, I mean, the players he met in those finals, it was all Higgins, Hendry, O'Sullivan, players like that. And it's been much the same with Lazowski, actually, because he's played Robertson twice, I think, in finals. Correct me if I'm wrong. Trump twice.
And Robertson, yeah. And Selby's the other one.
And he's played Selby, yeah. So, he's obviously coming up against the very best players in the world. You look at Dott, when he then wasn't facing one of the all-time greats in a final, he was playing Peter Ebdon, very good player, obviously, but not of the same level as Higgins, O'Sullivan and Hendry. He did win, and, of course, that was the World Championship. So I think that's what Lazowski needs. He needs to get to a final and maybe not play someone of quite that level. That could be the turning point for him. People say a lot of things like, if he keeps knocking on the door long enough, well, it's bound to open eventually. Well, it isn't. I mean, you could apply that to Jimmy White, for example, in the World Championship is the most obvious example. You can knock on the door forever and it might not open. And the other thing people say is, well, once he's won one, the floodgates will open. They probably won't, actually. I don't know if he's of that level that the floodgates will open. But what I do think is it is becoming, a much, much bigger psychological barrier now with every final that comes and goes without him winning. I do think if he wins one, you've got to remember, Lazowski is still one of the youngest players in the top 16. Most of the other leading players are much older than him. So you do feel if he could get one under his belt, he'd probably win a few more somewhere along the way. But it'd be great to see him do it because he's great to watch and such a nice lad as well, as we always say. But feels like we were saying all those things a few weeks ago, weren't we?
He's very relaxed, laid back, Jack. I can't remember whether I've told this story before, but at the shootout, as you go back to that last year, he came in and did a frame of commentary with me because he'd won his match and
we get
the players in. And he's quite relaxed about how it all worked because at the end, like as the whatever frame we were doing coming to a climax, I sort of, said good luck to you, Jack, in the next round. There's still a sort of minute and a half of the match to go. And he took that as his cue to leave. So he literally, people talk about dropping the mic. He literally dropped the mic. He just dropped it on the desk, slapped me on the back, said, thanks, man, and left. So how can you not like the guy?
He's absolutely. Yeah. He's just one of the most, any listeners who've never met him, he is honestly one of the most likable, genuine people you could ever meet. That story actually reminds me of, I've mentioned it on the podcast before, I used to present live Premier League football on the radio, and early on, it was actually just before I'd started presenting it, the original presenter was still there. And the feature match one day, the live game we were doing was Manchester United and Aston Villa. Now, if you're covering United against Villa on an Irish radio station, you obviously get Paul McGrath to come and do the co-commentary. And Tom Tyrrell, who I think is quite well known over in England, certainly in the Northwest region, but he was our main commentator at the time. And about 5 minutes before half time, Paul McGrath stands up. And someone's taking him by the hand. And then Tom basically knows you can't have your co-commentator leaving 5 minutes before half time. So he tries to pull him back down into his seat. And eventually it emerged that Paul, being, again, really, really obliging sort of guy, had agreed to conduct the halftime raffle and had also agreed that he would go down 5 minutes before halftime. I just genuinely don't think it had occurred to him that he was still going to be on air. So similar story. So Jack's not in bad company there with someone who was once one of the best footballers in the world. And Jack himself is one of the best snooker players in the world and showing, you know, real consistency now over the last while. And like I say, it would be great to see him win something soon. And you would think on balance, like I say, no guarantees, but, you know, considering as well his age, the likelihood is something will fall for him eventually.
Let's hope so. But of course, it's the era of Trump. And inevitably, discussion turned to, you know, where he sort of stands in the pantheon. It's maybe a bit early to say that because he's still, you know, we still don't know what he's going to achieve. My view on it all is, I think to be considered an all-time great in snooker, you have to win multiple world titles, but you also have to win lots of other tournaments. The World Championship is the one pinnacle event. It's a tournament way out ahead of everything else. But if you just won six world titles and nothing else, that wouldn't put you on a level with Steve Davis and Stephen Hendry, because they and Ronnie and Selby and Higgins and Williams and these people who not only won the major titles, but they won all the other things as well. That's another sign of greatness, actually, being able to turn up week in, week out and win events. Now, Trump is doing that, so that's half of it done. What he's got to do now, I guess, is try and win more world championships. Personally, I think he will. We'll see over the next few years. Carry on.
Well, I was just going to say, think back on this, right? We did about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, something like that, we did our top 10 players of all time. Now, we both picked the same 10 players, we just had them in a slightly different order. If Judd Trump had done nothing prior to November 2018, would he have done enough since then to be in the all-time top 10? I think he'd be in contention, purely on the basis of what he's done in that period of time. Because what is it now? Is it 13 ranking titles plus the Masters in 2 years, 2 months and 2 weeks, actually? Yeah. Is the period of time he's done that in. So he might have done enough even in that period of time to put himself in the all-time top 10. I was actually thinking about this the other day, the all-time list. I think everyone agrees O'Sullivan and Hendry are first and second. Most people put O'Sullivan first, but I think everyone would have them as the top two. And then I think everyone would have John Higgins as number three on the all-time list. I'm going to predict that by the end of this decade, Trump will be pretty much universally regarded as at least in the all-time top four, and very possibly overtake John Higgins to be number three on the all-time list. I just don't see how that won't happen. The only way it wouldn't happen, I think, well, there's two possible things which are quite similar to each other. One is that he will lose the hunger for more success. But it seems to me at the moment, the more success he gets, the more hungry he gets for more of it. It's a bit like Stephen Hendry was very similar to it. And the other possibility, of course, you've got to say for a man of his age, what happens if he has a family? And then obviously his whole life changes and can he put in the same dedication? But even then, I mean, we've seen people who've been in that position and it hasn't affected them at all. So we'll see. But he just seems to be on such a positive, relentless trajectory in his career at the moment that it's just very hard to see how he won't go on to keep going in this way right through, as I say, to the end of the decade.
Well, he played some great shots along the way, and James Corbett has emailed about this. He said, during the recent German Masters, social media went crazy with replays of the two amazing shots played by Judd Trump. The black with check side dislodged the red off the cushion, and the green to hole for brown. Although they were fantastic shots, I can't help but think of the silly things Alex and Jimmy used to do with the cue ball back in the 80s. The conditions nowadays are obviously far ahead of what they had back then, so I can only imagine the action Judd gets on the cue ball is helped by much more reactive cloth. Looking back through some footage from the 80s, it just shows how talented Alex and Jimmy were with what they could do on thicker, heavier cloths. It's nice to see Judd bringing some flair back to the game. James actually then also said footage of him trying to recreate these shots.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that, James. What I would say is, of course, what they didn't have was social media. In those days, if Jimmy White or Alex Higgins played an exhibition shot, if you weren't watching at the time, it kind of disappeared into the ether unless it was reshown at a later date. Now, something, and this is a good thing, I think, for snooker, is something like that, you know, does go viral in the best sense of the word.
Yes.
And it creates huge attention. I mean, the shot, I commentated on the black to the red, and both myself and Neil were sort of looking at it thinking he's actually got to, if he wants, because he was on for a century, if he wants to get on this red, he's got to pull something special out, and he did. The green was a kind of shot that Jimmy used to play, definitely, or used to try and play. But ludicrous, really. I mean, just the amount of topspin he had on it to stop the cue ball. But brilliant as well. Those sort of things get people talking.
And I think he regards a lot of shots like that as quite routine. I mean, you think back to Jimmy in his prime and he played some wonderful shots, but he tended to do it if he was playing well and feeling very confident in himself. Judd would be eyeing up a shot now. He'd see a shot like that and he'd think, well, that's the obvious shot to play. He wouldn't see it as being outrageous. The other thing as well is I think he has more of a tendency to play these outrageous shots in a live situation. Now, I'm not saying Jimmy and Alex never did, but a lot of the great shots Jimmy used to play were when frames were well and truly won. Judd will play them at a key moment in the frame, and he's been like that for 10 years, and that's a very big difference. But I do think the point about the cloths being different now and that favouring Judd and the fact that it was harder to play shots like that, you know, back in the era of Jimmy and Alex, I think there's absolutely no question about that. That's definitely true.
Yeah, OK. One final thing I want to say about the German Masters. I want to say congrats to Phil Seymour, who is the MC, very good MC, but also he did the interviews at the end of the final. They're not easy to do those because you're always going to be dealing with someone who's lost. And in the case of Jack, he'd lost 9-2. The runner-up usually wants to get out of there. We've seen a few of those interviews that have not been great over the years from, you know, professional broadcasters. I mean, there used to be a standing joke at one of the tournaments that they were going to be, you know which one I mean, we're going to be bad. He did a good job and got good stuff out of them. Trump spoke very well about Brandon Parker, of course, the trophy was named after. And I always think that's important, actually, at the end, that you leave with that sort of feeling that, yeah, you've not only watched a good snooker match, but actually the people playing it, you can kind of relate to. And they both spoke well. It's hard for the runner-up, but Jack spoke well. Judd spoke well. It was a nice way to end. And Phil played his part in that, I think.
So we'll see more of that sort of thing in the future, perhaps.
There we are. Let's hope we won't hear more of that sort of thing. Now then, 2 weeks ago, I made some extraordinary controversial comments about the brown ball. I think I called it a troublemaker. And I won't lie, there's been a backlash. From supporters of the brown
ball. That's why you did it. I think you wanted to provoke a backlash.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we have done. David Burney in Canada, whose email we'll return to, raises some other interesting points. But this is what David said, okay? And I can take this, David. I don't mind. You know, it's a passionate subject, obviously, the colours of the balls. He says, those are some tough words being said about the brown. Taking on a shot to nothing from bulk and being successful in potting a red, the brown is a great colour to roll up to. If the brown was disturbed a little and moved closer to yellow or green, it sets up a great wall to be behind to lay snookers. Also, a big shot always in clearances is brown to blue. If that went wrong, you could be in trouble, lose the frame, or lose that high break you were running. So go easy on the brown. And then he says, did I mention my mother's maiden name was Brown? Maybe I have a little bias. Well, that's okay. Paul Prescott. Now, I also mentioned Wayne Brown, the toad. Former professional. And this email just ties everything up in a really nice way. So Paul Prescott, he said, your reference to former pro Wayne Brown in the context of altering the colours of the balls reminded me of the one and only time I played him. For a few years in the 90s, even David Dimbleby can't get this sort of content. He said, for a few years in the 1980s, I played in a team snooker summer league. Up to that point, we had always played during the autumn and winter and never played competitions during the warmer months. Wayne had played in our local leagues in the St. Helens area for many years, but I'd never played him until this summer league. He had to give me a very big start as he was so much better than me, but I managed to win. I remember feeling a bit guilty about beating him as he cleared up all the colours at the end and the way he moved the ball around the table for his next position was superb. I only won due to the start he had to give me. But the reason why it suddenly came into my head was the fact we were playing Snooker Plus with orange, 8 points between pink and blue, and purple, 10 points between blue and brown. We had decided to play the Summer League as a Snooker Plus competition just for something different. I vaguely remember how much more difficult it made the game, as having more balls on the table, they tended to get in the way of each other. So, of course, we were talking last time about Snooker Plus and how the balls, how the colours of the balls came about, and that kind of, and Wayne Brown came into it as well, so that has sort of brought all the subjects together.
Yeah, Wayne Brown, I think it was the Grand Prix he did well in. Back in 94, I think he maybe even got to the quarterfinals, or certainly at least the last 16 of it, and Joe Swale beat him. I remember Clive actually compared him to Darren Goff, the cricketer, in his style. Now, you might think, how can you compare the style of a cricketer to the style of a snooker player? But now, I don't know a great deal about cricket, but I do know about Darren Goff, and I actually thought it was quite a good comparison.
Well, there's a guy who emailed me about Jack Lazowski comparing him to David Gower. Very kind of easy on the eye England batsman, very talented, but also he was known for now and again getting out a bit cheaply.
Right.
So anyway, James Cook on this subject, he said, really.
Can we just go back to the Snooker Plus for a minute? This is the thing that, and we mentioned it, that, you know, always arises. Where do people get an orange and a purple ball if they want to play Snooker Plus?
Didn't we establish there was a purple ball shop or something?
Oh yeah, well, a mythical one. I definitely remember many, many years ago playing on a snooker table that for some random reason did have an orange ball. Well, we weren't playing Snooker Plus. I'd love to know what the story. I was in Northern Ireland at the time, actually, now that I think of it, when I was playing. So maybe it was something to do with the old unionist persuasion or whatever. So there are orange balls out there, and clearly from that story, purple ones as well.
Wow. Okay. James Cook, he said, really, by the way, thanks for it. I had a lot of people, because you mentioned we should have a theme tune, or somebody did.
Oh, yeah.
Don't think it was you, but anyway. And a lot of people suggested various things. In fact, Dave Tindall sent me a playlist. So thank you for those. Anyway, James said, read the discussion about the colour order of the snooker balls. How about the colour of the bays? Why is it green? Could we have different colours for different events? Has Barry Hearn thought of selling the table space to a sponsor so they can put a logo on the bays, or a massive crown in the centre of the table just for the Triple Crown events? What I would say about that, James, is do not give them any ideas. I don't know why it's green bays. I mean, I suppose is that not the natural colour of bays? I don't know.
I can shed a lot of light on this. Right. I think the reason it's green is because it's billiards was originally meant to resemble croquet. And often croquet is played on grass. So that's as far as I know. The other thing is,
there's footage of Clive online demonstrating this by playing croquet. If you can find that on YouTube, that's worth seeing.
I'm going to go off and do it now. Forget the rest of this podcast.
Yeah.
I had seen snooker on television with a blue cloth.
Okay.
Many years ago on a Super Channel.
This wasn't just your TV was on the blink, no?
Oh, well, actually, yeah. Well, no, of course, we've discussed in the past the ITV Glow. So.
Yeah.
No, this definitely happened. It was around about the late 80s, early 90s. There was an extraordinary period where, like, Barry Hearn at that time was promoting a lot of unusual sort of events. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. They were just different formats and things like that. And a lot of them, for some reason, ended up being played in Monte Carlo. And certainly, I remember some of them being played with a blue cloth on the table. And this was the kind of random stuff that used to show up on Super Channel, as it was at the time. So, in fact, Clive may well have been doing the commentary on it. So it has been done in the past.
Okay. Well, if there's any footage of that out there, then let us know. Mm. Richard Westcott, the BBC science correspondent.
Oh, yeah.
He did write to us about the break-off. He said, thanks for your thoughts on the break-off shot. I know Michael said we shouldn't mess with snooker, so here's my plan to mess with snooker. Okay. Make the black worth 8 points, or even 9. It would encourage players to take bigger risks to get in onto the black rather than settle the pink or blue. Sometimes change is good. Cricket's had everything from 4 to 8 ball overs. Didn't rugby penalties used to be worth only 2 points? Getting rid of the back-passing football was great. Dave, I think you're being harsh on the brown, by the way. It's the first colour that's really worth anything, especially for us amateurs who only expect to get a red and one colour per visit, if we're lucky. The yellow looks pretty, but is a complete waste of space, like a few expensive footballs I can think of. He said, I know everyone says it in their emails, but keep up the good podcast work. I'm filming a lot of COVID stuff in hospitals at the moment. It's welcome escapism. I can't tell you how hard those medical staff work. 12-hour shifts in horrible masks. You see, this is why snooker players need to be careful what they say about this topic, because there are people, and Olivia Martil is one of them, the referee, on the front line this every day. He also said, up until now, my dad was the only person I knew that liked snooker, and he can't watch half the games because he gets annoyed if the person he likes starts losing. I barely saw Alex Higgins when I was a kid because my dad couldn't stand him and had to turn over if he started winning. Well, all I can say about that, Richard, is seek out that YouTube footage of the final. I mean, changing the value of the colours, I do not agree with, because, you know, it's a completely different game then. There's no more 147s for a start. I don't agree with that, I'm afraid.
I'm going to guess that the likelihood of someone listening to this podcast and taking it and running with it and the game changing in that way is pretty unlikely. So it's, I don't think it's likely to come to anything much. But why would you do that? I mean, why tamper with the game? You know, we had a lot of this back in the days of bad administrations. It was just pointless changes. And, you know, people talk about things that have been tried in other sports. I mean, the back pass rule, I mean, that was because there was a big problem in the game and the game needed to be improved. If anything, the players in snooker need to be held back because the standards are almost getting out of hand. So No, I don't see any. I don't see any reason to change anything actually about the game itself and the way it's played on the table in the slightest.
Okay, we're going to move on. We've had a lot of other emails. I think what my intention is, and maybe next time we'll go through some of the ones that are built up. They're all. I don't delete them. If you haven't, if yours hasn't been read out, then it's nothing personal. We'll try and get through them. At another point, before we move on to the puffery and lies section of this podcast, there is another snooker in popular culture thing that I came across by chance. There's a channel in Britain, Talking Pictures TV.
It's called, oh yeah, it's not out of someone's shed, isn't it?
Well, I don't know about shed. I think I heard it was a house in Watford. Anyway, it's a free channel, and they show some extraordinary films you just do not see on any other channel. Partly because they're not really of the sort of quality. I mean, they literally look like they're being played off VHS tapes. But who cares? Because they're films that otherwise would be kind of lost. Anyway, I was watching a film. It was called The Man Who Haunted Himself, starring Roger Moore from 1970. So he's pre-James Bond, Roger Moore. There's two Roger Moores in the film, but essentially the scene is he's playing snooker, and the idea is the character is really good at snooker. So he pots a red, he pots a pink, and he pots a red, but after potting the pink, he doesn't pause to allow his opponent to put the pink back on the table. So I'm sorry, Roger, that's a foul.
Yeah,
it just is. You know, you can't make your own rules. You know, anarchy lies that way. So, but anyway,
like having 9 points for the brown or for the black or something like that. But you know, they all lead to anarchy, as you say.
So the man who haunted himself, Talking Pictures TV. I was also watching a thing on ITV. What was that the other day? It was some police drama. I think it's called The Bay. It's on at the moment, and there's a scene where someone's drunk in a pub and someone has to come and sort of collect them. And there's some sort of snooker on in the background on the telly, but it looks like they're streaming the qualifiers or something because it doesn't look like TV snooker. It's a snooker table, but it's very dark. I don't know whether they've had to sort of block out the logos or something like that. Maybe that's it. But it kind of almost looks like it's just like sort of, I don't know, China Open qualifying or something. Anyway,
here's another one I came across last night. Connections with snooker. You know this? Have you watched the? I think it was on ITV. Anyway, the drama quiz about this.
Oh yeah,
that
yeah.
Was done, who was,
yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, John Parrott's in it. So we were watching the first episode last night, and they show actual footage of all the awards that Who Wants to Be a Millionaire won for like best quiz show or whatever. And of course, at these award ceremonies, before they announce the winner, they kind of divide the screen into four quarters and show each of the nominees. So one of them must have been a question of sport, because a very young looking John Parrott is sitting there, obviously having gone to represent Question of Sport. So he gets a cameo appearance in quiz.
I did watch that. Michael Sheen is very good as Chris Terham.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
he really is. Anyway, we're now going to move on to the main topic. So, yeah, puffery and lies. So when I started on the circuit, 20-odd years ago now, you were told certain things that you basically, because you knew no better, you believed. For example, for a long time, people would say that when we had all these 8 o'clock starts on the BBC, people would say if the 85 World Final, they said the 85 World Final last session started like 6 o'clock. So on that basis, it would have been 2 in the morning, you know, if it started at 8. For years, I just accepted that. It turned out it didn't. It was 7 o'clock. Mm. That wasn't true. And little things like that have gone up over the years. And even, I'll start because the two things are related. You often hear this two cushion escape, if you snookered, coming off two cushions, trying to thin clip the red or whatever colour, back to bulk. People, it's kind of, you hear people say Cliff Thorburn invented that. Now, is that really true? I don't think so. I think more like what's likely is potentially that shot may have had its provenance in North America, potentially. And so obviously Cliff, as a Canadian, maybe was one of the first players to play it in a tournament. He wouldn't have invented it. I wouldn't have thought. Same as Stephen Hendry. We often hear he invented splitting the pack from the blue. I mean, he can't have been the first person to do that, but maybe was one of the first to employ it early on in frames rather than
took it mainstream, you might say.
Rather than teasing out reds and so on, he just got into the pack early on. The point is, these things are kind of said and they're accepted, But are they really true?
I'll tell you one thing that I think he maybe did. Again, not quite invent, but you used to very rarely see players taking on long blues to bulk pockets. I think he was the first to really do that with any regularity. You might have thought it would be someone like Jimmy White, but no, I think Stephen Hendry was the first to really do that on a regular basis. That you would see, again, you would see that as a routine shot, that if the blue was on its spot and the cue ball was 3 or 4 feet away, that you would actually attempt to pot the blue into a bulk pocket. I think that became routine largely on the back of Stephen Hendry doing it. That would be my memory of it anyway.
Well, a listener, James Buck, has inadvertently started one of his own.
Right.
James Buck, I suppose if he overtook him on the motorway, he'd be passing the buck. But anyway, another one of those this time next week. Anyway,
Let's not read any more of this email. Let's just say the buck stops here. Sorry, had to do that. Move on.
So anyway, James says, I wonder if Patsy... he says, I wonder if Patsy Fagan gets annoyed about it being said that he won the Masters without a 50 break tag. I played in the World Seniors qualifying school in Reading recently and had the privilege of playing on the table next to Patsy at one point. As I struggled away, all I could hear was Patsy Fagan 58 and Patsy Fagan 64 coming from the referee on the adjoining table. Well, James, of course, it wasn't Patsy, it was Perry Manns.
Yeah.
Patsy won the UK Championship. Perry Manns won the Masters in 1979, I'm going to say.
I think you're right, yeah.
And his highest break was 48. Now, but the thing about that is, I mean, he was just a very different player. He was an out-and-out potter. He didn't play position. He wasn't interested in that. He was interested in potting, putting balls awkward, making things difficult. So it was actually Perry Manns. I'm not being like trying to be clever, trying to correct you, but he's not. Patsy's off the hook on that score.
Yeah. Well, from a similar sort of era, a little bit later, there were some extraordinary myths that spread for many years about players and their backgrounds leading into big successes. I mean, an obvious one is Joe Johnson when he won the World Championship in 1986. Now, one thing that was said about him was that he had never won a match at the Crucible before. Now, that was true. I think he'd only played there in 84 and 85. Dennis Taylor beat him heavily in one of those years, and it may have been Bill Werbenick beaten the other year. But anyway, it was true that he hadn't won a match at the Crucible. But one thing that was said for a long time was that actually he had never won a match on television before he'd won the World Championship. And it was only some years later it occurred to me how unlikely that was. Now, I knew that the biggest single factor in him getting into the top 16 was getting to the final of the Professional Players Tournament. That wasn't televised, so okay, fair enough. But he had also been in the semi-finals of the Mercantile Credit Classic. And you kind of think, well, how could he have done that without playing any matches on television? Nowadays, of course, actually, you could reach a semi-final, say in a home nations event, without any of your matches being televised. But the Mercantile, which incidentally, there goes our weekly mention of it, certainly at that time, there were 16 players in it, so there was only one table. So basically every match was televised, and he would have beat Cliff Wilson and Warren King to get to the semis. Now, surely it must have been on TV. He was then actually heavily beaten by Cliff Thorburn, who you just mentioned, in the semi-final. So that was one myth. The other myth, of course, was about Dennis Taylor, famously winner of the 1985 World Championship. But as you would say, Dave, he did win another Triple Crown title a couple of years later when he won the Masters, beating Alex Higgins.
He just didn't know it was, because he hadn't been invented for 15 years.
Indeed, yeah. You know, he would have made a big effort to win the UK if he'd known it was going to be. But it was said at the time, and the remarkable thing about this is, of course, Dennis has such a bad record in the Masters, he's never won a match in it before. Now, that persisted for a really long time, because there was a chap, Rob Nothman, who was very well known on BBC Radio. I don't know if he's still doing anything on it, but he was the press officer and MC at the Masters in the late 90s and into the early 2000s. And there was a really comprehensive media guide produced one year, and we were sitting around waiting for play to start. I think it was on semi-finals day. And Rob took out this almanac, I suppose you would call it, of past Masters history. And he asked this question, and it was something along the lines of, who did Dennis Taylor beat in the first round in 1986? And there was almost like a sort of, sympathetic air. Oh, no, Rob, no, you must be wrong about that, because everyone knows Dennis Taylor never won a match in the Masters. And, of course, we looked at it, and it turned out he had actually won a match the previous year. The year before he won it, he'd beaten Doug Mountjoy in the first round. And, of course, we all ended up looking very silly then, particularly guys like Phil and Clive, who'd been around for such a long time and had been perpetuating this myth, when actually he'd won a match in the Masters the year before. So things like that
Well, yeah.
And, but, yeah, can build up.
But I think that's the thing. Like, so many of these things you've heard from people you believe, you know, reputable people who've actually heard it from. It's like Chinese whispers. It gets repeated. Yeah. So Clive's heard it from someone. If Clive tells you it, you're going to believe it. But he's just heard it from someone who's heard it from someone who's heard it from someone who initially had made a mistake. The one that I wanted to mention, because this is, I've seen this written in newspaper articles. So the 1996 World Championship, Ronnie O'Sullivan played quite an ill-tempered match against Alain Robidoux.
Yeah.
Played a lot of shots left-handed, won easily, 10-2. There was a bit of stink after Robidoux complained that he thought he was taking the mick out of him and so on and so on. Now, it's at some point it was reported, and it must be years later, because it never happened, that Ronnie was going to be disciplined for this. But what they did was they sent him to play Rex Williams over three frames to prove he could play left-handed, and he won all three frames, so they said, OK, well, no problem. I mean, it's such a ridiculous story. First of all, he'd proven he could play left-handed in the match. He won the match 10-2. He hadn't broken any rules, so why he would be disciplined, I'm not so sure. You can play right or left-handed or both. There's nothing written down to say you can't. But here's the other thing about this, and this is why it's provably not true. At the time, Rex Williams was actually leading a coup attempt to get rid of the WPBSA board. So why would the same board choose him as the person to get involved and you know, help prove that Ronnie could play left-handed? But what I would say is, this has been repeated so many times now. If you asked Ronnie if it had happened, he'd probably say yes. Just because
I think he told that story.
Yeah,
I think I'm with you. I mean, it definitely did not happen. But he's heard it so many times, and it's so long ago now. He probably thinks he's just forgotten it.
Yeah,
that it must have happened. But I'm nearly certain I've heard him actually tell that story.
There you are.
Absolutely. It's one of these things that not only did it not happen, but for the reasons you're pointing out, it simply couldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So.
But you do see that. I've seen that as offered up as sort of evidence, obviously, of how good Ronnie is. The fact he, you know.
Yeah.
But you don't. I mean, you don't. I don't think his reputation is resting on that story, is it? I think there are other things you can point to that he's done that maybe. And speaking of which, another myth actually is regarding him is his maximum in '97, which for years we were told was 5:20, and somebody actually went to the trouble of timing it from the first shot to the last. It turns out it's 5:08, which is even quicker. It was just at the time, I think, I don't know exactly why it was recorded as 5:20, but it must have been just from when they started counting, presumably from when Mick Price went back to his seat. And maybe the cue ball was still running, I don't know. But anyway, 12 seconds were taken off it. So it was quicker than we thought.
Ronnie also comes up in something that, you know, you and I, given our backgrounds, would certainly have come across a lot over the years, is players being misquoted. And one of the most famous, arguably the most famous press conference at the Crucible, but of course that was the Alex Higgins one in 1990, the rambling speech he gave after losing to Steve James. So maybe apart from that, perhaps the most famous press conference at the Crucible was the one that Ronnie gave after he beat Stephen Lee in the quarterfinals in 2002, and he decides to have a go at Stephen Hendry. Now, he said something about, I'm going to send him... he said, oh, if I beat him, I'm going to say, yeah, go back to your sad little life. Then he said something about how I'm going to send him back to Scotland. And somehow these two quotes became fused by the very next day. It became gospel truth that he had said, I'm going to send him back to his sad little life. Now, that wasn't too bad, because it was basically the gist of what he said, I suppose. It was only putting a couple of things together. But the best example of this, of a myth building up around something that was said, and it was Joe Swale. I think he was 12-8 down against John Parris, and he came back to beat him 13-12 in the second round and went on to reach the semi-finals. And afterwards, John Parris, I mean, he was obviously absolutely gutted to lose a match in that way, but he spoke quite graciously. And you talked about how I think Joe had actually beaten him a few times in the previous few years. And he used the line, oh, Joe's been such a pain in the neck for me over the last couple of years. So one of the tabloid journalists twisted that round. It appeared in the papers the next day. The championship has been overshadowed by backstage rows among the players. with John Parrott describing Joe Swale as a pain in the neck. You know, the funny thing is, I remember... the next morning coming in and seeing that in the paper, and I showed it to Clive, and he was disgusted that this had been written. And when that journalist showed up later on in the morning, Clive actually took him to task over it, over the fact he'd said it. But there are so many things like that that just, I mean, players get misquoted on what they've said, but more often than that, I think, you know, the excuse people always use, oh, I was quoted out of context. Well, you know, you can only really use that excuse if you then go on to explain what the context should have been. But in situations like that, there's, you know, a clear example of when someone was quoted out of context. That one kind of passed by. No one really remembers it very much, but there are bigger examples of it, certainly, over the years.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't like that phrase, I was quoted out of context, but sometimes they are. Sometimes they are. And things like that, they may, I mean, we can laugh about it now, but actually, the danger of things like that is they create a sort of mistrust between the players and the media. If you've said something entirely innocent and it looks like you're having a go at someone, you're not there, therefore that disposed to come and do any more interviews. Sure. But I was going to ask you, one actually, because you are from the Emerald Isle. Ken Doherty, obviously 97 world champion, and I mean, listen, I helped Ken write his autobiography, so
yeah.
I've been involved with this. But the story was, we always see, well, there's two stories. One is that the police, the central police station in Dublin, didn't get any calls that night.
I think that's true.
Yeah, it sounds like it should be true. But the other one is that a quarter of a million people turned out for his bus ride through the streets of Dublin. Now, I've always thought about that. And Ken, you know, it was a big deal, that was, winning that and beating Hendry. And Snooker's always been popular in Ireland. But it strikes me, because I've been to Dublin, it's a big city. Mm. Surely a lot of those people, well, they're not just out anyway. I mean,
yeah, there might have been a quarter of a million people on the streets, but yeah, they were maybe going to Brown Thomas or something.
Do we know they were there for him? I don't know.
Well, put it this way, right? That was a thing, my word. I mean, anyone listening to this who grew up in Ireland at that time, we loved a good open-top bus ride. Mm. I mean, we had so many of them. The only one I ever remember going to, actually, because I wasn't at that one for Ken. I think I was doing something else that day. When Stephen Roach won the Tour de France, he had an open-top bus ride through the streets of Dublin the next day, and I definitely remember being there for that. But the biggest one ever was when we got to the quarterfinals of the World Cup in 1990. And it was actually going on at the same time as you were playing Cameroon in the quarterfinal the following night. There was this incredible parade, like real historic scenes, actually, on the streets of Dublin. Now, I don't think it's ever been said there were a quarter of a million people turned out even for that. And you could not move in Dublin. I mean, it was just basically the centre of it was just full of people. So, no, I can pretty much confirm that. There's no way a quarter of a million people turned out on the streets of Dublin for Ken Doherty.
Maybe Ken had so much to drink, he was just seeing double. Maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, maybe so. So only 125,000 then. A mere 125,000 people. Let's move on, actually, to the 2001 Masters. Which,
please do.
Yeah, which, of course, Fergal O'Brien was in the final, so we've had our Mercantile mention. Now we've had our Fergal mention. Yeah. Okay, so now our work here is done. But of course, he was beaten in the final by Paul Hunter. Now, the whole story about how, you know, he was well behind, I think he was 6-2 down at the end of the afternoon, and he said afterwards in the press conference, oh yeah, we, you know, went back with my girlfriend and we reverted to plan B. All of that actually happened. But, like everything else, the story has grown legs over the years. And I remember it being claimed somewhere along the way that when Paul said that in the press conference, that there were a load of tabloid journalists sitting at the back of the room, almost falling asleep. And it was said they were there, little imagining they'd get a front page story out of a snooker tournament. Well, if they were little imagining they were going to get a story, why would you spend your Sunday night, you know?
Let's just look at it logically. I mean, Fergal, we love Fergal, obviously, we talk about him all the time.
Yeah.
He's not gonna get a load of tabloid hacks going down to a snooker tournament. You're not gonna get anything of any tabloid interest out of him. And at the time, Paul wasn't really very well known at all. So the fact that they met in the final, that would not attract the interest of anyone other than sports
No, absolutely. The only people who come to cover a snooker tournament are there to cover the snooker. Now, they might get a story, as they did in this case. Yeah. But the idea that, you know, tabloid journalists, you know, who don't go to cover the event, just turn up in the press room in the hope that something interesting is going to happen, which, by the way, they won't get in the paper the next day anyway, because in those days, as we discussed, the finals never finished till about midnight anyway. And I remember Jazz 625 was even delayed for the coverage that night, and that was never on till after midnight. The other thing, though, when I heard that myth being put forward, it was also said, suddenly these journalists came to life and started pushing people out of the way and climbing over tables and chairs to get to the front of the room to talk to Paul about it. The press conference room at Wembley Conference Centre only went back about four rows. So, I mean, you could be sitting in the back row and you could practically reach out and shake hands with the player. So why would you have to push past people and shove your way to the front of the room? So
well, that, Yeah, the thing about that Plan B thing, the reason it was such a good story is because it was so innocently said. Paul didn't say it thinking, oh, I'll get on the front page. He just said it like as an aside. He had no thought at all that will become a story. That's why people liked him for that, because he wasn't a contrived thing at all.
Yeah, it was so unfiltered. You know, I mean, it was just, yeah, he wasn't looking for publicity at all. And I think also just, you know, Paul, he had that kind of angelic look about him. You know, yeah. I'm not saying he was an angel or anything, but he almost looked like a choir boy, you know, very good looking lad. And he just looked so young. And I think that added to it all as well. So, yes, I mean, the basics of that story were true, but it's grown legs over the years. As we said, that's 20 years ago now. It's only been 3 years since Mark Williams did the naked press conference. Can you imagine the legs that story's going to grow over the years?
Well, let's hope he's only legs. But yeah. yeah, yes, and thankfully, the one thing I'll say about that is he did arrive in a towel, thankfully. One that had to be, I imagine, thrown away afterwards.
I'll tell you one thing that did happen, actually. I can't remember the guy's name. You'll probably remember it, but there was a guy there, a Welsh guy. I think it was from BBC Radio Wales. I can't remember his name.
Gareth Black.
That's it, yes, that's him. He was sitting next to Mark. And basically, that was the situation. Mark was in one seat at the top table. Gareth was sitting in the other table. Now, Mark had taken the towel off at this stage, and he managed to keep a straight face by making some sort of carry-on style joke in his opening question, something about, well, let's look at the bare facts of the match. I mean, it was a masterclass in keeping a straight face.
Well, dare I say, he had...
Here we go.
He had full view of the Triple Crown that night, anyway.
Oh, yeah.
A rather distasteful note. Do you have any more? Or?
No, that's about it, really. I mean, I'm sure I'll think of more now over the next week. We might come back to it.
Well, what we haven't covered are most of the ones we've started, of course.
Yeah, well, indeed. Probably set off a few of them today. Yeah. There are myths about what used to happen back in the 80s. I mean, they've become so mythologized. You know, it's like people talking about, you know, Woodstock and what they got up to at Woodstock, and then you realize they weren't born until 1974 or whatever. But there are stories from the 80s and what used to go on then. I mean, the game's profile and its status in Britain was at its peak in those days. That is absolutely true. But people say things like, oh, you know, during the BBC events, they used to come on 10 o'clock in the morning and they'd be on live all the way through to midnight and beyond. And it's simply not true at all, is it?
Well, I've said this before. I think I quoted James Graham, the playwright, who said that so often our memories are actually memories of memories. So when you think of a childhood holiday, you don't remember it raining. You just remember it being sunny. You know, you remember it's very much sort of rose tinted. And people even remember Christmases where it's been a white Christmas, even though I don't ever remember any white Christmases. So you remember it the way you want to remember it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And also from that era, and I mean, you'll back this up. People used to show at the end of the World Championship every year, the BBC would make a sort of musical piece where they would show moments from the championship, and there'd be kind of, some of them would be sort of funny moments. And I mean, basically all it would involve would be someone maybe raising their eyebrows to the camera or whatever. Now on the back of that, I think a mythology is built up that in the 80s, they were all cracking jokes every couple of minutes. And also that this myth that there was this wonderful camaraderie between all the players and they were best of friends and, you know, they'd go and have a drink together afterwards and, you know, sing in the bar together with their arms around each other's shoulders, whatever the result. Actually, a lot of the players in those days really had it in for each other. So these are the things that build up around that era. I'm fairly sure people will email in with some other ones over the next week or so.
One ironic one, actually, that you do hear when people talk about Barry Hearn is that he's the man who made snooker big.
Yeah.
Now, it's ironic because he's actually the man who has saved snooker and has actually reinvigorated it. But in the early 80s, I mean, Barry was ahead of the curve because he owned snooker clubs before the boom. So he was well placed to then benefit from that boom. Obviously, meeting Steve Davis was a massive thing as well. He was certainly one of the first people to recognise the commercial possibilities of snooker. But what made snooker big was that it was on the BBC. That's what made snooker big. And, you know, they gave it sufficient coverage that it had that exposure. And he very astutely and very shrewdly kind of rode on the back of that. But he didn't put snooker on telly. But, of course, the irony is, you know, he has now, in this era, done wonders for it.
And when people talk about that era, they say, oh, you know, it got put on television and became a big success. Up until then, it had only been a pub game. This is another one of these huge myths about it. I mean, the only way you could have a snooker table in a pub And it does exist in some places, is when you have basically a separate room out the back, which is massive, and you have tables in it. The idea you could have a snooker table in the middle of a pub, it's so big, and you need queuing room around it. It's just...
It wouldn't make any case at all. It wouldn't make any commercial sense for the pub. You wouldn't that space for tables and so on and people to drink. We were talking about this last year in Southport because a rumour went round, again, it turned out to be a myth, that there was a table in one of the pubs in Southport, and someone went down to investigate and there wasn't. So they must have taken
that was
out.
The end of that.
They must have taken out, or maybe it was never there. But yeah, it's very rare indeed. Anyway, well, let us know any myths maybe that you want that you're not sure about, or you want correcting, or that you've heard, including any that we've started ourselves. You can email us snookerscenepodcast@mail.com.
Go on.
I was going to give it again, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com.
Yeah, never mind any of that. I've remembered, I knew there was another car company had sponsored a tournament. Peoples used to sponsor the Scottish Professional Championship back in the 1980s.
Wow.
And they say we're niche on this podcast.
Well, wait till we start running adverts. I must warn people that we may, in the future, have adverts. We've been approached by someone... And listen, we're complete sellouts. I mean, if you want to send me free products, I'll read anything out. McVitie's biscuits, whatever you want.
Well, they don't need to bother now because you've just given them a mention.
Well, here's the thing about talk about getting sidetracked. My nan years ago, she wrote to McVitie's because she was convinced that the biscuits were getting smaller, right? And she wrote this stiff letter, basically complaining, and they sort of sent what was a little bit of a stonewalling letter back. They didn't admit it. They didn't deny it. But she effectively, and here it is, the payoff, she effectively was accusing them of taking the biscuit.
Yeah, she was.
That's a true story. But I've always regarded the McVitie's as the biscuit you can trust. And I will say that for money. In all seriousness, there may be a couple of adverts in the future, but that is the only change. And you can scroll through them. I mean, obviously, I don't recommend that because we might get some money for it, but you can do that. And there's no, you know.
I just love the fact that your gran, you know, made such a big issue out of something that, let's face it, is pretty trivial. And here you are now, all these years later, running a multimedia campaign against the Triple Crown concept.
Let me just say that, okay, I now am the only person who doesn't mention it. People emailing about it, you mention it. I do not. I said I wouldn't mention it, and I don't.
But you've said that about six times. And it keeps coming up.
I mentioned it in regards to Mark Williams in a rather off-colour way. In terms of the concept, I've made my points about it well known. Other people have made their points about it well known. I'm happy to move on. It's not me that's bringing it up. That's all I'll say about that.
Well, you see, the thing is, if you've got these causes, you shouldn't move on from... I mean, I'm never going to let go of my campaign to rid us of the curse of the crucible.
Well, you don't have to worry about that this year. Now then, let's squeeze in one last email. This is from Satjinder here. I really enjoy the best snooker podcast out there. I think he means this one. He says, one question I've always wanted to ask, how do the professionals work out the angles to get out of snookers? Is there one single method that players use, or do players use different methods? Well, I think like any shot that you play, it comes from experience. And I mean, it is actually, you know, you see, I mean, I mentioned the two cushion escape. That is real skill to be able to pull that shot off, you know. Obviously,
incredible, actually, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, club tables can be pretty bad, I know, but to be able to just, even when they miss it slightly on the first one, you know, to be even that accurate, it is something you learn as you go on. It's not the first thing you think about when you're playing. You think about, you know, potting, really, and break building. But it's so important, and it seems to me now players are better than ever at getting out of snookers. They just, and laying them as well. I mean, Trump is a genius at all of that stuff.
Well, it's because they're playing so much.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're not just practicing. They're involved in so much actual match play that, you know, that's the way to do it. I often wonder about that, actually. You can teach players how to play position, how to pot, obviously the technical side of the game. I think tactics and safety can really only come from playing matches, that you only build it up over the years. But, I mean, that two-cushion escape you're talking about, it is so difficult to play. You put the average club player in that position, give them 1,000 goes at it, and honestly, they might get it right once. And if they do, it'll only be through luck. It won't be because they've played it particularly well. I love the question, actually. It reminds me of the 2015 World Championship final, asking how the players work out the angles. There was a Chinese woman who turned up to the Crucible to cover the 2015 World Championship. After the final, she came out with two extraordinary questions. Sean Murphy has just lost in one of the best world finals, certainly in terms of quality there's ever been. She asked him, how would you feel if you'd been playing a woman tonight? Which was an incredible thing to come out with. But then Stuart Bingham, I mean, you know, like nobody has ever been happier to win the world championship. Nobody's ever been happier about anything than Stuart was that night. And she asked him this question. So you are very good at playing these shots. Is it some formula you have to do with the geometry of the balls? And that's really technical. I mean, our friend, the BBC science correspondent, probably wouldn't even go this much in depth into a question. And Stuart just sensibly said, I couldn't even begin to answer that. So it has been brought up before.
Yes. No, I mean, it's like anything. It comes from practice. But some players, you know, just seem never, like Mark Selby, you know, if you win a frame against Mark Selby having needed snookers, you've done well, I think. That's increasingly true of Trump as well. Although I always think the longer a frame goes on where players are after snookers, the more likelihood someone's going to go in off or some misfortune will befall them. Anyway, I hope that answers your question. A lot of other emails that we haven't had time to get to.
Well, we've got to go back because I can't leave this out. I had this written down to mention the snooker myths. I don't want to leave this one out because it was one that was started entirely deliberately, spitefully, and maliciously.
Okay. And, these are all words that we enjoy here. Yes.
Well, funny you should say that because I was about to say, when I've used those words, you know it must have started in the press room, which is where it started. I think it was about 1996. Now, people might find this hard to believe now, but it was actually big news back then within snooker when someone reached 100 career century breaks. And I think it was Willie Thorne who did it at the International Open. And he was only something like the eighth player ever to do it. Now, I'm not going to say who it was, but there was a journalist in the press room who wasn't liked at the time. So
that narrows it down.
Yeah, well, no, this guy was really, really disliked. I think he had even been tied up to one of the pillars in the Crucible press room. Right, so you know who it is now. Yeah. So the other journalists agreed, right, he's really annoying us this week. We're really going to drop him in it here. So Geet Sethi, who was one of the Indian journalists, and of course a very good player himself and a former world billiards champion, was brought in on the joke. And I think he was the only guy who hadn't fallen out, because Geet's such a nice guy, he hadn't fallen out with this particular journalist. So the other said to him, look, at some point he's going to ask you, who are the other seven players to have made 100 centuries? And they were all really big names. So Geet had been told, he'd been briefed to say, with a straight face, which he was very good at, to say that the other players were, say, Stephen Hendry, Steve Davis, etc., etc., and Barry West. So when inevitably the question was asked of Geet, he said, oh, yeah, the other players were such and such, and, and Barry West was one of them. And this guy was doing reports for loads of different radio stations, all of which contained the claim that Barry West was one of these legendary players who had made the 100 centuries. He probably still believes it today, because I don't think anyone ever actually told him what the truth of the matter was. So that was a whole different class of snooker myth, because it was done quite deliberately, and as I said, with a bit of what we might generously describe as good-humoured malice. Incidentally, Barry West...
The best form of malice, I always find. Yeah.
Yes. And incidentally, Barry West's actual total of career centuries was 5.
Well, what that proves is you can't trust anyone. But you know, you can trust. That's right, McVitie's biscuits. Anyway, no, sorry.
I thought you were going to say us. That definitely would have been a myth.
I'd like to. I mean, my nan's passed away now, but I'd like to get my hands on that letter to see what they actually said, because I know they didn't deny it. That's all I'll say. They didn't deny it straight out. Anyway, that is it from this edition. As I say, in future, I think we're going to try and go through. There's a lot of emails. What I would say about the emails is you're always great to get them. I would say, this sounds like I'm having a go at people. I'm not. The shorter the better, I think. Direct questions are good. I've had a couple about maximums, but this is, I think this is episode number 142. It would make sense to do a special on maximums when we get to 147, which will be in a few weeks' time. A lot of other topics have come up as well. Keep them coming. Let us know what you think of the shootout. Obviously, in a different, completely different setup to what we used to, no crowd. And then we go on and on. Championship League, Welsh Open, of course, he's not in Milton Keynes. It's actually in Wales at the Celtic Manor in Newport, which I think everyone's quite happy about, I think. And then so on and so on. We've got the Players' Championship. That's just February alone. And then very soon, it's only 2 months for the World Championship, amazingly. I guess the question there is, can Judd Trump keep his incredible run going in the biggest tournament of them all? We will see. Unless you've got anything else to say, I think that's it.
Well, just to say, we are definitely coming back to, because we didn't have time to go through them today, those emails people sent in with suggestions for a signature tune for us. I think we have to revisit that in a future episode.
Well, yes, I'll just very quickly, let me see if I can find, bear with us here. See, this is an advert now would be a good idea, wouldn't it? So, for example, James Cook, for example, you know, came up with. I mean, this sounds like actually that time Chris Downer put them on the tube.
Oh yeah.
He's got Coldplay, Yellow, Green and Grass of Home, Tom Jones, Brown Eyed Girl, Van Morrison, Blue Monday, New Order, Lily the Pink, Scaffold. He actually says that was number one the day he was born. And Back in Black, AC/DC. So there's a sort of if you had a sort of mixtape of that, that might be. My feeling on a theme tune is it sounds like a lot of effort. And also, you have to pay royalties to people.
Oh, yeah. Look, it's an entirely theoretical conversation. To be honest, right, I know this is going to sound like the least original suggestion of the year, but if we were going to have a sig tune, I'd just put on Snooker Loopy. I think, you know, it has to be, hasn't it?
Yeah, or maybe, yeah, or that might be a bit mainstream. Maybe we could have, like, an old ITV theme tune from the 80s or something.
Oh, anyway, actually, yeah. I'll go with that, yeah.
We're just sort of yakking now, so we will bring this to an end. You can email us, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. And by the way, if you do listen on Apple Podcasts and you like what you hear, and if you've got this far, you must do, frankly, if you can review us, that means other people get to find the podcast more easily. Because so many people have said to me, and this has been going, this podcast has been going 5 years now, maybe even six. So many people have said they've only discovered it in the last year during lockdown. So there's all the back episodes to listen to, but we have a lot of new listeners. But if you can help other snooker fans find it, we'd be very grateful. But that is it. So as we always say, i.e. we're saying for the third time, thanks for listening and goodbye-bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.